You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast covering the 3rd to the 9th of July edition. My name's Chris Parr, I'm joined by writer Matthew Rice, books editor Karen Shook and deputy news editor John Morgan. Have UK universities' London campuses been targeted by criminals running visa scams? The Home Office is investigating what it reportedly calls a concerted attack on higher education institutions. That's the topic of this week's lead news story. We'll hear more on that in a second. The overuse of antibiotics, the most powerful people in China, and how to think like a freak are three of the topics covered in books reviewed in this week's books section. More on that shortly. And what happens to academics' papers and their works in progress when they die? This cheery subject is the topic of our cover feature penned by Matthew this week, about which he'll tell you more very soon. But first, London branch campuses are in the news at the moment. They're coming under the Home Office microscope. Been a lot in the news about this recently, but what's happened this week, John?
So this all goes back to a BBC expose on the language testing firm ETS, whereby some of the tests run by that firm were found to have been operated fraudulently, and people were being waved through without having the required levels of English, and then universities and other colleges were accepting these qualifications. And following up from that, the government has announced various actions against universities and colleges as it tries to be seen to be acting after the BBC's expose. And one particular area of concern for the government is the London branch campuses run by UK universities, which are primarily aimed at international students. Universities outside London want to get a slice of the international student market in London, because that's where international students in the main want to be. And the Immigration Minister has announced that there will be an inquiry by the QAA into these London campuses. And I spoke to one immigration expert, a law firm, who suggested that it may be the case that these London campuses have been targeted by the supposed visa fraudsters. And there's a suggestion from the Home Office that institutions have been the victims of what it calls a concerted attack by fraudsters.
But you'd think, I mean, these are sort of universities that have their main campuses all over the country. Why the London campus is specifically targeted? You imagine they'd have similar processes in place at both their main campus and their branch campus.
Well, the question posed by the immigration expert that I spoke to is whether the standards of visa compliance and monitoring are the same at the branch campus as they are at the parent university, because these campuses are small and they're being run a long way from the parent university, which is outside London. Is it possible for universities to really be monitoring the standards of visa checks at the campuses? And in some cases, the campus is a partnership with a private provider, in which case it'd be even harder for universities to check up on what's happening there. So the suggestion is that the London campuses might be a weak spot in universities' visa compliance, which has been exploited by visa fraudsters. And the University of East Anglia, which had a London campus, announced earlier this year that it would be shutting it down. And I spoke to the UA Vice Chancellor Edward Acton, who said he was glad that if it does prove there's a weak spot in London campuses, he's glad UEA is closing down its campus. I asked him if he was kind of directly anticipating this action by the Home Office when he decided to close down the London campus, but he said it was much more a case of being extremely pleased and motivated by the quality of what Norwich can offer, which sounds a bit Alan Partridge.
It does, doesn't it? But these English tests, it's strange, isn't it? Because these English tests aren't carried out by the university all the time. They're in certified test centres. If you, get a certain level in these tests, then you're deemed suitable to study in the UK. So it's not really the university's fault, is it?
That's right. ETS was one of the test providers approved by the Home Office. I think there were five providers at that time. Universities would say, well, we accepted a qualification that was approved by the Home Office as evidence of students' language capabilities. So many people would say they are the victims in all of this as well.
Yeah, it's a discussion that's going to run and run, no doubt about it. But that's page 6 and 7 in this week's magazine. Many international students in the UK come from China, of course, which is the subject of one of the many books in this week's book section. Karen, what else do you have for us this week?
This week, Rachel Condry of the University of Oxford covers a book called Children of the Prison Boom, Mass Incarceration and the Future of American Inequality. It looks at the price paid by the children of those who are incarcerated, certainly collateral damage. And that book is by Sarah Wakefield and Christopher Wildman. We've also got Philip Roscoe, who is a Book of the Week author a while ago, a University of St. Andrews academic. His Book of the Week was I Spend, Therefore I Am, The True Cost of Economics. He made himself not a lot of friends amongst the academic economist world. He's taken on Dubner and Levitt, the authors of Freakonomics, and some very successful follow-ups to Freakonomics. Their latest is Think Like a Freak, I guess, presuming to go from theory to action. And Philip was not a big fan of Freakonomics and its, he thought, fairly simplistic explanations for people's hidden economic behaviour, why drug dealers still live with their mums and so on. So he wasn't expecting to be impressed by this book, which does recycle some very well-worn stories, such as Van Halen and No Brown M&Ms in their rider, which anyone who reads the music press or has watched TV has heard about for years. But Dubner and Levitt, I guess, have just come across it.
Indeed written for the music press, as you yourself did.
But Philip Roscoe was quite surprised to see that there were a few things in this book that actually made sense to him. And I think he's coming around a little bit, although he suggests that they may be straining at the boundaries of their own economics. I think he's trying to encourage more people to leave that discipline behind, or at least the strictures of what he sees as being classical economics limitations. We've also got a review of a fantastic book by Robert Sitton called Lady in the Dark, Iris Berry and the Art of Film, an extremely important critic, writer, and key personality in the British film industry and also in Hollywood. Hard not to imagine that if this were a man, this is a name we would all know. This biographer, academic biographer, Robert Sitton, has done a great job of really presenting a life that would strike you as quite odd if you saw it in a screenplay. Lots of color. John Turney reviews Martin Blazer's book Missing Microbes, How Killing Bacteria Creates Modern Plagues. This has been covered in a lot of press, not just in the science pages, the argument being that the effect of antibiotics is storing up a heck of a lot of trouble, and not just resistance to antibiotics, but the changes that it makes. And for those of you who know the story of the Nobel Prize winning scientists who discovered that Helicobacter pylori was the cause of stomach ulcers, and this was seen as a wonderful thing that this was discovered, it may turn out that ridding ourselves of that bacterium is not as great as we thought. And our book of the week, Kerry Brown, is the author of The New Emperors, Power and the Princelings in China. He was the first secretary in Beijing for the British government, went on to become an academic, was at Chatham House, is a contributor to Our Pages, and now heads the China Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. Our reviewer, Jonathan Mirsky, who is the oldest of old China hands, I would say, or certainly the most experienced, covered the Tiananmen Square massacre, was indeed beaten during that, was Far East editor of the Times, is surprised at the extent to which Kerry Brown is so frank about what goes on in terms of the Chinese leadership. And in fact, Mirsky's view to me, expressed to me, is that a lot of academics who are Far East specialists feel constrained in what they can say about Chinese politics. Mirsky himself was thrown out of the country in 1993 for things he wrote for The Observer and for The Times later. He thinks this book is surprisingly frank and says if a Chinese citizen were managed to have published this book, he would be in prison now. Mm. Brown actually says that some people accuse him of being pro-China, at least as often as they accuse him of being anti-China. But he's certainly probably one of the most eminent scholars and one of the most highly placed writing about China now. And he does speak Chinese and has experience of the country. It's quite a chilling look at the way the party system works there and who becomes leaders. They are, of course, all men.
We should flag up the books podcast as well while we've got you here. Your latest one was with former Labour MP David Marquand. A good interviewee?
A fantastic interviewee. He obviously has no shortage of experience in speaking to the press, and his book Mammon's Kingdom was about what he sees as the malaise that is a particularly British malaise, our love of money.
Well, that's available where you got this podcast. Just scroll back in time a little bit and you'll find it there. Finally, what happens when an academic dies? In practical terms, much the same as what happens when anyone dies. But what of their work and sort of more to the point, their work in progress? Matthew, you've been finding out.
Yes. Well, I spoke to some academics about what they were planning to do with their papers and books and projects, some of which haven't happened or some which have happened, and what they do with all the old papers. And some are very, some just throw it all in the bin, and some are very, classify them very well, and some never quite get round to sorting their things out, which is perhaps true of many people, and therefore leave their children with the task of what to do. And and again, some of the children, you know, take a very ruthless line. And there's a case here, a woman called Karen Average, whose father was writing a sort of definitive book about anarchism in America. And as he got older and frailer, he said, she's a writer too. He said, well, would you finish it for me? And she said, yes, that sounds like a good idea. And she loved her father and so on. And little realizing that it would take 6 years' work to do this. And there is a terrible danger that you take on projects which, become almost impossible because you're not an expert in the field and have very limited readership. So that the danger is always that you kind of put your life on hold through carrying out, a parent's wishes, either express or implicit wishes. And you do it out of piety, but it becomes a terrible burden, and you have to. The only way to make it work, I think, is to somehow make it your own and make it your own book as well. Mm-hmm. So another woman,
Robin Foyer Miller.
Robin Miller, yes. Mm-hmm. Her father was at work on a large biography of the American political philosopher John Dewey, and several publishers said, we would like you to publish this. And she just thought, well, she didn't know enough about the subject, and it would just mean, kind of giving up all the other projects she wanted to do, and she said no. On the other hand, she found among her father's papers a long correspondence with a Japanese woman who her father had been very involved with before he married. And what she hadn't noticed, they'd carried on a correspondence, for the rest of their lives, as it were, a very intimate correspondence. It's unclear whether they were lovers necessarily, but they were certainly. It was certainly an extremely intimate, detailed correspondence, dealing with a lot of aspects of post-war Japan and so on. And she thinks this is an amazing source of material, and she's considering, making a book out of this, not quite sure what sort of book. Mm-hmm. Although this is, of course, her father, it's the last thing on earth he would have wanted to have published after
it. It's not what he would have wanted.
It's a story of what you inherit and how you deal with these papers, which is a very, very difficult issue. Because, obviously there are some cases where the heirs to the Tolkien estate or the C.S. Lewis estate may spend their whole lives on, dealing with the consequences of their parents' work. But there's also a lot of money in it for them.
Yeah, the Silmarillion, the Tolkien book, was finished by...
Exactly. So then it kind of makes sense. But I think the danger is you do something out of piety, put your own life on hold, and there's no money in it either. So that's the danger. But most of the stories I tell are people who found a way not getting involved in projects like that, but have found a ways of making useful use of their parents' papers.
Mm. It makes you wonder what has been thrown out by the less sentimental children of academics who perhaps didn't go through with quite such a keen eye. Page 34 for that feature this week. That's all we have time for in this week's podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've spoken about, or indeed anything in the magazine, you'll find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+. You'll find us on Twitter, of course, too. So do get in touch if there's anything you would like to add. But for now, that's all from the THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.